Welcome to the roundtable panel for this Friday morning. We are starting now. We are starting late because we did a WAMC interrupted, but we are going to 11. You're barely losing anything. Listeners, please be comforted that we will be discussing so much going on in the news this morning. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue. You can pledge to the station and keep us uninterrupted anytime at WAMC.org. While you're on your computer, you can also email us, panel@WAMC.org, if you would like to ask our panelists anything or weigh in on the topics we're discussing. Please keep your letters reasonably short, to the point, and on topic, and give them a quick proofread if you can. The music this morning is by Las Almas Nuevas, and the playlist is posted online at WAMC.org. Our panel this morning, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm doing all right.
You have to get that mic much closer to your mouth, please.
Sorry. Good morning. Good morning. I'm doing all right. I would like to note that it's law enforcement week, so thank you for all of those in law enforcement who keep us safe. And I'll also note that something I know I've talked about over and over again, but I still can't get over what happened on January 6th. And there is a plaque that was supposed to be put in the U.S. Capitol by March of 2023, and the Republicans have refused to allow that to be put up in honor of those law enforcement folks. So I think in honor of Law Enforcement Week, they should stop the hold on putting up that plank and honor those people who protected our democracy and those law enforcement people, the 140 plus who were injured that day and five who died as a result of it. But thank you to all those who keep us safe.
Also joining us in studio this morning, Joseph Paul Mountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin. Beau, this is our first dance.
Yeah, Sarah, I'm super excited to be dancing with you.
Thanks for coming in this morning. Also joined, of course, by attorney and former U.S. Congressperson and New York Assemblyman John Faso. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Great to be with you. And it's not raining yet, so happy about that.
Run between the raindrops. The heat and sun has really had everything blooming. And after all that rain, the sun has been very, very buoying, I find.
Yes.
Also in studio today, Aaron Pasitti, Siena College Professor of Economics. Hiya, Aaron.
Good morning, everyone. I'm just excited that John brought donuts this morning because I didn't, despite having an extra half hour, somehow I managed to whittle it away without actually eating anything.
That can happen.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome. I notice he hasn't taken a bite yet. But those are the famous golden harvest from Valencia.
The free advertising.
Among the best. The best. We love Golden Harvest.
Unbelievably, astoundingly great. And if he doesn't start eating it soon, it's going to disappear.
So if you hear some lip smacking, you'll know who it is.
Try to lean away from the mic while you're chewing. It's not an ASMR show. It is a current events discussion.
It's not Food Friday yet.
Not Food Friday yet. That is coming up at 2 on Vox Pop. Let us discuss. We will start with yesterday's birthright citizenship oral arguments in the Supreme Court. Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments. I'm setting this up with text from the SCOTUS blog, which is a very helpful resource. And if you'd like to, you know, study for yourself, it's scotusblog.com. Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the federal government's effort to be able to generally implement President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship, the guarantee of citizenship to virtually everyone born in the United States. President Trump set the events leading to Thursday's arguments in motion on January 20th when he signed the executive order ending birthright citizenship. Under the order, which was originally slated to go into effect on February 19th, children born in the United States would no longer automatically be entitled to U.S. citizenship if their parents were in this country illegally or temporarily, for example, on a work or student visa. Birthright citizenship was written into the Constitution following the Civil War when the 14th Amendment was adopted in 1868. With the words, "all persons born or naturalized in the United States," the amendment established the citizenship of black people, including former enslaved people freed during the war, who had been denied that right in the Supreme Court's notorious 1857 decision, Dred Scott versus Sanford. During arguments yesterday, the Supreme Court appeared divided over whether a federal judge has the power to block President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship while the case moves through the lower courts. The Trump administration told the justices it should be able to at least partly implement the order, although several justices in recent years have expressed skepticism about so-called nationwide injunctions, which bar the government from enforcing a law or policy anywhere in the country. During more than 2 hours of oral arguments, it was not clear whether a majority of the justices were ready to bar such injunctions altogether. Arguments on Thursday mostly steered clear of the question of whether Trump's order is legal under the Constitution, which is known as the merits of the case, instead focusing mostly on procedural questions. We invited Beau Breslin specifically today, because he's a Constitution guy, to help us understand and discuss. I'd like you to begin, Beau.
Oh, thanks, Sarah. So I could, I promise not to monopolize. I could spend a lot of time talking about this. But let me just say a couple things. Those who tuned into oral argument probably thinking that this would be a civics lesson in 14th Amendment birthright citizenship were probably a little disappointed, because it is a largely technical question about whether or not universal or nationwide injunctions is appropriate or applicable. So I'll just throw a couple of things out on the table and then open it up for the conversation. One is 2 points about injunctions, right? So about nationwide injunctions. One, I think the media is off, including SCOTUS blog. I listened to oral argument. I've listened to a lot of oral arguments before, and it seems to me that it's not quite as divided as people are saying. And I read the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, and they all seem to think that it's divided. I don't think so. You know, you have Brett Kavanaugh saying certain things. I actually think the court is kind of painted into a corner here, because injunctions are important, and nationwide injunctions have been used. And the argument about whether or not you can use class action suits as opposed to nationwide injunctions, it was pretty clear to me that the court thinks that class action suits are not expeditious enough. And so I actually think the media is wrong. I think this one will be largely one-sided. There might be a couple people who, Thomas and others, who disagree. But I think this will be a fairly easy case for the court to say, yeah, unfortunately, we don't love injunctions, but we're nationwide injunctions, I should say. But we have no alternative. And so I think the court will come down on the side of New Jersey in this, or the states in this that particular thing. Two, I would say the court's emphasis is there are injunctions and then there are injunctions. An injunction about the 14th Amendment, which I'll get to in a second, an injunction about birthright citizenship carries a little bit more weight than an injunction about sort of a routine construction project or something like that. So I actually think the court is aware of the fact that this is a bigger deal in terms of birthright citizenship than just a traditional other sort of routine injunction. So then I'll say two things about, I also will mention, this is a little bit of judicial chicanery, a little bit of judicial trickery. The U.S. government, Sowers is the attorney, solicitor general. He wants to have the argument about injunctions because ultimately he does not want to have the argument about the merits of the case, about birthright citizenship. That said, I'm going to go out on a limb here on the air, risky, risky moment, and say I actually think the question of whether or not the court will support this kind of unorthodox birthright citizenship question, which we can get to, I think that'll be closer than the injunction question. That is to say, I think there are conservative members of the court, in particular Alito and Thomas, who might in fact agree that those temporarily here are not subject to the jurisdiction, quote unquote, thereof. And as a result, I actually think the birthright citizenship, the actual merits of the case, will be a little bit closer than the injunction question. My final point before I open it up is, damn, you know, sorry, folks.
No, that's okay.
This is the 14th Amendment we're talking about.
Teresa fainted. It's okay.
I'm reaching for the dumb button.
No, we can do one of those.
I mean, I just got to spend a moment saying and just acknowledging that the 14th Amendment is the greatest triumph of modern liberalism. And I don't mean liberalism as in democratic liberalism. It's about universal equality. It's about the protections of due process. And yes, it's about citizenship, the expansion of the tent of citizens, right? There have been many moments where we've had the expansion of the tent of citizens. When women got the right to vote, that was an expansion of the tent of citizenship. The first sentence was meant to settle the great question of citizenship. It was intended to constitutionalize the Civil Rights Act of 1866, but ultimately, this is the most arguably second only to the Declaration of Independence in terms of the majesty of American liberalism, the character of American liberalism is the 14th Amendment, and Trump decides on day one he's going to take pot shots at it. I just don't get it. And I'll leave it at that.
John Faso.
Well, I think Beau has given us a pretty good description of the matter. The media has gotten it a bit wrong because it's not really about the substance of the issue. It's going to be about the procedure. And there have been a number of instances, both from judges who were perceived on the left or right, where they impose nationwide injunctions. And what that does, it kind of short circuits the legal process, because you could have the whole purpose is to have cases percolate through the system. Ultimately, if there's a dispute between and among different circuits, court of appeals, then the issue gets resolved at the Supreme Court level. And there's a benefit to that because you have the virtue of different opinions, different legal analysis being brought to the fore in front of the Supreme Court ultimately. And then they can decipher and discern what should be the right outcome from a constitutional perspective. So I think that the issue of a nationwide injunction have been overused. But the question is going to be here whether, as Beau said, whether that is just a mere fundamental, whether it deals with a fundamental personal right and privilege under the Constitution, or whether a contract should go forward, or some item of federal spending, whether some judge sitting in anywhere in the United States can enjoin an administrative action on a nationwide basis. The substance of the issue, I think there's going to be the way you come down to this question on birthright citizenship, it's going to be, I think, where were the people in the country legally, and do their children have the same rights, as opposed to someone who comes in through a legal process, maybe an asylum seeker, someone that has a temporary protected status, whatever. So there may be a distinction ultimately that the court divines there. I personally do not like the use of executive orders for this. I think that is an overextension of presidential authority. I think if there is a question about whether or not an illegal immigrant has, and the child of an illegal immigrant has, the same rights as someone who came here legally but is not a citizen, whether their child is somehow different from the one of the parents who came in without following the law, that's a question that I think Congress has to decide. And I don't like it being decided vis-a-vis an executive order. So I think, you know, and I've said on this program many times before that I think presidents of both parties and Congress of both parties have allowed presidents to assert jurisdiction and power unduly, and because Congress either shirks its duty or doesn't want to decide. So I don't think this executive order is going to ultimately be upheld.
We will continue this conversation and hear from our heretofore silent panelists, Aaron Pasitti and Teresa Bourgeois, after this underwriting break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc in for Joe Donahue. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org, and you can help ensure that WAMC remains on the air uninterrupted by donating anytime at wamc.org. Our panel this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Beau Breslin, John Faso, and Aaron Pasitti, and we are discussing SCOTUS's hearing, the oral arguments about the executive order and birthright citizenship that took place yesterday. We heard from Beau and John so far. We will hear from them more, but first, let's check in with Aaron and Teresa. Aaron, you're up.
So I think the the use of injunctions is a result of increasingly polarized politics, where federal judges can kind of impose political outcomes on legal decisions. And the fact that, you know, that affects both Democratic and Republican presidents makes this a much broader argument. It's not just these judges are anti-Trump. I don't know the specifics, but I'm pretty sure that this happened a lot under Biden with the student loan forgiveness and some of those other programs. So I want to take a different angle at this point, and that is looking at immigration from an economic perspective and what birthright citizenship could mean for the long-term health of the U.S. economy. So, Beau, I like the terminology used, and I'm going to tweak it a little bit. Yeah. Immigration expands the tent of economic participation. And what most major, actually all major economies face is a demographic headwind. You've got declining birth rates. You've got rising cost of education. And some of the biggest factors that affect long-run economic growth, so not from one year to the next, but from decade to decade and from generation to generation, is obviously the size of the population, the quality of that population, meaning education levels, and then you've got capital, right? So the capital stock and the quality of those capital goods, namely technology. So when we're talking about birthright citizenship and immigration more broadly, that solves the labor quantity issue, is that you get an influx of workers, you get an influx of business owners, and that expands the tent of economic participation, which allows for, you know, modest increases in economic growth. Economists have estimated that immigration on net has a very small but positive effect on long-term growth rates. That just, you know, is a demographic tailwind. And during the labor shortage, you can say what you want about Biden's immigration and border policies during his term, but if everybody remembers the 2021, 2022, 2023 labor shortage, where firms were posting that, you know, sorry, we're closed today because we can't find enough workers, that problem would have been substantially worse had it not been for the influx of foreign-born workers that came to the country under Biden administration policies. So, you know, from a purely economic angle, immigration and by extension birthright citizenship, it, you know, obviously increases the size of the population relative to what it would be in the absence of that, and provides a small positive effect on long-term growth rates. So, but, you know, if birthright citizenship ends up being, you know, axed, if there are broader immigration restrictions and acceleration and deportation in the big, beautiful bill, all that's going to do is act as a stronger headwind in terms of slowing long-term economic growth. Narrows the tent of participation.
Bo, do you want to respond to that before we introduce Teresa, or are you just because you nodded?
I'm just super excited about what Aaron's saying. I do have data after Teresa goes that interested.
You're on.
Okay, so riffing off what Aaron and what John said, listen to these numbers. So the first couple don't have to pay as much attention to. There have been 127 national injunctions since 1963, 92 since 2001. There were 22 national injunctions during the first Trump administration, 16 under Biden, 17 national injunctions under the second Trump administration. Okay, so it's not a huge number, but then and it's not a direct correlation, but let's throw in the numbers about executive orders. So Trump has had 151 executive orders so far. 17, if there's a correlation, 17 of those have been nationally enjoined, right? 162 executive orders under the four-year Biden administration, 16, so 1 in 10 in the Biden administration, 1 in 9 in the second Trump administration. Last numbers, 220 executive orders under the first Trump administration, 22 were enjoined. So it's always about 1 in 10 that are getting enjoined. Yes, those numbers have gone up, and the court is interested in the fact that that's what Sowers, the Solicitor General, is talking about. Too many, too many, too many. But it's a new tool that's being used very equally across administrations. And for that reason, I think the court is just going to throw up their hands and say, okay, we'll just keep national injunctions. Because it's not like it's an anti-Trump thing. They're still, the injunctions are coming at one out of every 10 executive orders.
Teresa?
So I have a question and then comment, but a question on the national injunctions. It just seems to me that it will be difficult to create a one-size-fits-all. Because what you said, John, yeah, how does the court have a one-size-fits-all answer on national injunctions? Because isn't an injunction against an executive order having to do with a fundamental change to the Constitution different than maybe a very small aspect of law that they might have to settle. And so how do you, this is not a comment, it's more of a, I was trying to think through this yesterday as I was listening, and I'm glad that you both said that you didn't agree with the, because I didn't have an out, I didn't sense the same direction the court was moving than I was reading in the paper. So I'm glad that, that you folks who know more about this. But how do you do a one-size-fits-all?
The Supreme Court has had a four-part test, and I have to say I can't recite all four parts. But generally, it depends upon the magnitude of the issue that's before the court. And so if it's really a more localized issue, or if it's something that really isn't an emergency, something that should be allowed to percolate through the judicial system as opposed to one judge, one district court judge in one part of the country making a ruling that's affecting the entire country. That's what I think, especially Justice Thomas, Justice
Alito,
and others have expressed concern about, that it really interferes with the proper course of judicial decision making.
Except for when it doesn't, when it's like, I'm interrupting you. But this is a, like, how do you do a one? Is there one answer for everything?
There's not one answer for everything.
The court
will likely expand upon its four-part test and come up with a more refined way to analyze these kind of things. And basically what they're doing is they're telling lower court judges, they will be telling, I believe, lower court judges, hey, guys, restrain yourselves.
Be more judicious about it.
And don't think that you can just willy-nilly issue these nationwide injunctions, because, you know, frankly, that's not the way in which the system is supposed to operate. I think that's what this court will say ultimately. And it may be a rather broad decision in that regard.
Yeah, and I think, Teresa, I would say one more thing on in addition to what John said, which is, that's what the appeals process is about. Now, every single one of them, Elena Kagan is the most vocal about opposition to national injunctions from the left. So it's not just the Alito and Thomases of the world that are skeptical about it. And yes, I think the court will chastise lower court judges and say, don't keep doing this unless it's one of these moments where, as I said, injunctions are not all equal. But that's what the appeals process is about. And so that's what I don't understand, where the Solicitor General is thinking, okay, just eliminate it all. And the New Jersey Solicitor General said, you can't have a universal opposition to nationwide injunctions.
And the other effect of the other result of having frequent national injunctions is that more cases get placed on what some have euphemistically called the Supreme Court's shadow docket.
Right.
Because then there's only one way to deal with something when you have a one district court judge issuing a national injunction, and it percolates more quickly up to the Supreme Court. And frankly, I think judges, regardless of their inclination, be it more liberal or more conservative, they like to get things before them that have been thoroughly vetted and argued at the lower court level. You get something on this emergency docket. Well, they haven't had the time to have this thoroughly vetted and researched from a legal standpoint, and you don't have the conflicting arguments that may come from, say, different courts of appeal issuing divergent opinions on a fundamental important matter. So that's why the concern about the so-called shadow docket is directly related to things like these emergency and nationwide injunctions.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We do have a few letters, emails from listeners that we will read when we return. Our panel this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Beau Breslin, John Faso, and Aaron Pasitti. Again, you may join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org, and we will return with more of your Friday edition of the Roundtable Panel after news from Ray Graff. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc in for Joe Donahue. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. The panel this morning, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Joseph Palamountain, Jr., chair in government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, attorney and former U.S. Congressperson.
Support comes from Native Plant Trust.
New York Assemblyman John Faso. Sorry, something just played in my ears, guys. attorney and former U.S. Congressperson and New York Assemblyman John Faso, who has to leave at 10:30, just so everybody knows. That is planned and on his schedule. He's not huffing out, and we're not kicking him out. He's just leaving at 10:30. And we also are joined.
The donuts will be gone by then.
I'm leaving. I'm taking my donuts with me.
Also joined by Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti. We have been discussing yesterday's Supreme Court hearing the oral arguments about the birthright citizenship question, and we do have this letter from John who says, "All persons born, I want to know what part of all the right wing does not understand, because they are constantly trying to reinterpret the word all. And as for determining original intent, if Congress in the 19th century meant only former slaves, then they would not have used the word all. The attack on birthright citizenship is a direct attack on the Constitution, period, full stop, and a violation of every elected official's oath of office." We also heard from Ellen, who says, "If the court rules that children of illegal immigrants are not citizens, does that mean that all of us need not only our own birth certificates, but also our parents' birth certificates to prove our citizenship? Step aside, real ID. Thank you for all you do." That is from Ellen. Teresa, you wanted to talk about birthright citizenship.
Yes, I mean, I think for those who say, well, we need to carve out exceptions for people who are, quote unquote, here, you know, illegally or didn't come here legally, I think that there's a very murky middle here, and you're seeing it in the deportations, which some of it I don't think is that murky at all, but there's such a push for deportation that you need to step back and think about the immigration system is fundamentally broken, and Congress really needs to repair the immigration system and get some clarity. And because there's so much difference now, you have an administration who really doesn't want anyone to come in except for perhaps South African Afrikaners and a small handful of. I mean, when we're at the point where they are now pushing to end the. I can't recall exactly the terms that the Afghans
temporary protected status.
You know, to end that and make them leave. Those who helped keep alive a lot of our, you know, military folks and others, you know, there's not a sufficient clarity in the system to even, I think, have that conversation in a legitimate way. So if you do, in fact, believe that there are some people who are should not have birthright citizenship, I think there's a lot of clarity that needs to happen in the system. And it can't be. In this case, I think a lot of this is driven by the philosophy of Stephen Miller and some of the Project 2025 and other folks. And that's quite a different philosophy, I think, than others have had about a very narrowing of who should be allowed in the country. And so I think it's a tough question. But first, you have to do comprehensive immigration policy.
Can I say one more thing before we move on, Sarah?
Please do.
And that is, I used to say, and I've said a lot in the last, I don't know, what are we, 120 days in, that really the only constitutional crisis or moment would be if the Trump administration ignored, defied, rejected a Supreme Court opinion. I'm going to add one more to that. And that would be, I think we would be in a constitutional crisis if a majority of the Supreme Court, in fact, reversed what was 1868 birthright citizenship, because there are few things in the Constitution that are sort of fixed and a few clauses in the Constitution that are unequivocal. That's one of them, in light of the fact, as I've said before, it's sort of on the Mount Rushmore of greatness. I think if the court rules in favor of the Trump administration's interpretation of birthright citizenship, we'd be in a constitutional crisis.
And I found it astounding, if I was hearing correctly, in some cases in the discussion where they were talking about you didn't really have to uphold judicial order. And then you hear Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security person, pushing back on whether or not you have to uphold an order. And you hear it. You know, from the Justice Department, certainly from the president. You know, I think these are not, the Constitution is not a suggestion, right? maybe you can follow it, and court orders shouldn't be a suggestion of, well, if you like it, follow it, if you don't. I just think we're in some real scary waters here.
Anybody else on this one before we move on? Thank you all. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Let us talk about the One Big Beautiful Bill Act moving through Congress.
Don't call it that.
That's what it's called.
That's
Lisa?
Not. Yeah, it's called the Reconciliation Bill. It's marketing, please. Sorry.
Okay.
I'm fanatic about that.
I understand.
Marketing. It's marketing.
House Republicans are preparing to push their hard-fought package for tax breaks and spending cuts through its next hurdle today in the Budget Committee, but conservatives are warning that they could vote to halt it unless there are further changes. This from the Washington Post. Tallying a whopping 1,116 pages, so quite a tome of an act, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, marketedly named with a nod to President Donald Trump, is teetering at a critical moment. Conservatives are holding out for steeper cuts to Medicaid and other programs to help offset the costs of the tax breaks, but at the same time, lawmakers from high-tax states, including New York, are demanding a deeper tax deduction, known as SALT, for their constituents. Failure to push the package out of the Budget Committee would be a setback for Speaker Mike Johnson, who insists that Republicans are on track to pass the bill, which he believes will inject a dose of stability into a wavering economy. Teresa.
Yeah, I think let's just talk about the energy and commerce portion. Karen Tumulty from the Washington Post Opinion, she has an interesting piece called, and she talks about the Democrats' masterclass in resistance that they did during the markup. Just on the Medicaid portions and the Affordable Care Act, it will throw over 13 million people off of the rolls. They have quote-unquote job requirements, which have been tested in some places. I mean, they're so confident in their job requirements that, interestingly, it appears now in the current version they don't go into effect until after the election. And so because I think they realize that they're going to hurt their own constituents. And they're doing a number of things. They have not been able to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. And so what they're doing is putting all sorts of barriers to entry. They are shortening the amount of time that it's open enrollment. They are dramatically reducing the number of people to assist in open enrollment and making a whole other series of changes. But I think you're seeing just fundamental change across the board, whether it's in Homeland Security, where they want to dramatically reduce funding for FEMA and move it back to the states, and the Department of Education, where they want to eliminate it, move portions of it to other places and move it back to the states. You see it in the EPA. I was listening to their hearing, and all sorts of programs where they've not only rescinded grants that have been awarded, they want to reduce all sorts of departments, and in many cases, they were saying move it back to the states. So you have this pattern of cut the funding, move it responsibility back to the states. So what's the economic and we could go law enforcement too. You know, they were talking about it being law enforcement week and touting the fact that the Republicans support the police and the Democrats don't. But of course, you didn't see that in January 6th, and you don't see that in a number of across the board cuts in their budget, as well as rescinding over $800 million in grants that were already awarded for violence prevention and a whole series of training programs and such. So I think that there's a lot of internal conflict within the Republican Party, both within the House and between the House and the Senate, about where this is headed. I think that they are, as a technical matter, they are trying to do too much in one bill. In many cases, some of the members, it seemed that they were surprised at some of the things that are in their proposals were in there. That's happened on both sides of the aisle in the past, but more so here. But the biggest issue is what is the impact going to be of all of these cuts? And just in rural America, for instance, what happens when you have deep cuts in Medicaid at the same time you have deep cuts in the SNAP and food security programs at the same time you have, well, just across the board cuts. And it impacts rural hospitals. They close down. Those rural hospitals are the economic engine for that community. You have job loss. You have job loss, but you have no food security. Oh, you have LIHEAP cut as well. I mean, it's just across the board. It seems like it's a spiraling down, I think it's up to the House Republicans and Senate Republicans to determine whether you want to move forward in this potential spiraling down that will be coming in conjunction with the impact of the tariffs.
John Faso.
Well, I think the fundamental problem is that, and both sides are doing this, but they fail to understand that in fiscal 19, the federal spending was about $4 plus trillion, $4.3 trillion. It's now approaching $7 trillion. The spending increases that occurred because of the pandemic and many of the things that occurred during the pandemic have mostly not been reversed. And I think the problem that we have fundamentally in the country is that we're looking at deficits, annual deficits that are more than $1 trillion. And we're on a pattern, a glide path to having $2 trillion deficits. That's going to create fiscal havoc. It'll potentially cause the dollar to lose its standing as the main means of transaction in the world. And so we have to control the budget and the budget growth. Now, Medicaid is a perfect example. The proposals that they've made in this Medicaid reconciliation package are actually rather modest. I frankly don't know why they've suspended the work rule until 29. That doesn't make any sense to me. I think if you're able-bodied and you're not working and you're not in training and you're not disabled, you should be able to work. And that should be a requirement. The other anomaly, and this came from the Affordable Care Act, when they did the Medicaid expansion, they told states, we're going to reimburse you 90 cents on the dollar for Medicaid. Whereas in New York State, our Medicaid reimbursement for the poor, the mother with three kids who's poor, the person in the nursing home, the disabled person, it's 50 cents on the dollar. So it's created a perverse incentive to drive costs to the Medicaid expansion. There should be some changes there. They didn't even make that change in this proposal. So on SNAP, for instance, they're saying the states, which now don't pay anything for food stamps, that they should have some skin in the game since the states administer the program. It's fully federally funded, but 50-50, the administrative costs are shared between the states and the federal government. There are many states that have error rates that exceed 10-15% in terms of overpayments, even some underpayments, but many states are not processing the SNAP applications on time. So the proposal is not to cut the benefit. It's to say the states, okay, you're administering this program. You're going to now share, you're going to have 75% of the cost to administer the program. We'll pay 25%. And if you administer the program properly with a minimum of errors, we'll pay 95% of the overall cost. So what they're trying to do basically is to shift some of these costs onto the states, in the SNAP in particular. But the Medicaid system, anyone who objectively looks at the way the states have manipulated the Medicaid formulas to impose, they impose, in fact, Governor Hochul's budget this year has a new $2.5 or $3 billion tax on managed care organizations. And the tax is really a charade because they impose the tax, it generates a higher federal reimbursement, and then when the federal money comes in, they repay the tax to the entities. There's over $100 billion in the $800 billion annual cost for Medicaid nationally that is going to these so-called intergovernmental transfers, which are just fiscal gimmicks. So, you know, a lot of this is trying to deal with the fact that we have this overall, you know, financial deficit, and we have to address it. And the tax bill, most of the pieces of the tax bill are simply a continuation of current law. Now, we can argue whether, oh, that's a benefit. The Democrats will say, oh, you're trying to do this to give tax cuts to the rich. Well, after the tax cuts were enacted in 2017, the wealthy paid a higher portion of taxes than they did before. And right now, the top 5% pay 40% of the income taxes. They make 27% of the income in the country. The top 10% pay 70% of the income taxes. So our income tax system is heavily progressive, to use that term, not in the local political terms.
In a mathematical sense.
in a mathematical sense. So, you know, the if you don't extend the tax, most of the tax provisions from 2017, you wind up with a massive tax increase. So that's really, there's a lot of sleight of hand and dishonesty in the rhetoric on both sides. Let's acknowledge that. But we have to face the fact that we're spending more than we can afford as a country. Federal spending is now 25% of GDP. Before the pandemic, it was 22%. Taxes are about 18% of GDP, and that's not really changed from the the 2017 tax cut, which, by the way, I voted against. But be that as it may, this is the fundamental fiscal imbalance we have. We are spending way more than the revenue that we have. And just you're not going to solve it by so-called taxing the rich more, because they are already paying a disproportionate share of the taxes. And that's fine. But to simply say we're just going to tax the rich and that'll solve this problem is simply wrong.
But can I?
Sure.
A couple quick things, John. You can extend some, but not all of the tax cuts. So, for instance, there seems to be common bipartisan agreement on the child care tax cut. Maybe not on exactly what it should be, but it should be, right? I don't think anybody says we have. Well, there might be a handful of people, right?
And they have that in this bill as well.
Right. So, but you don't have to. The Republicans are framing it basically as the majority of the Republicans as an all or nothing. Right, that you have to extend all of them or not. And I don't think that that's the case. I think that they could be more judicious about what they do and don't extend, because that did explode the deficits in the last Trump go-round. But the other thing is with the Medicaid approach.
So that's where I disagree with you, because the we produce more revenue after the tax cuts than we had before. So, I mean, I think, you know, given
how, what's
giving
the difference between how much did Trump add to the deficits?
He added, and most of it was on the spending side. And, you know, and I've said this before on this program many times, 72% of all federal spending is interest, Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid.
And national defense.
National defense is in the 28% of other spending. National defense is 28, and everything else is 28%. It's Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and interest is 72% of all federal spending. And which side of the budget is growing faster? It's the 72% side. That's the fundamental issue we face.
So Medicaid. Think about what did the Clinton administration do with Medicaid? They went after waste, fraud, and abuse, but in a methodical, really going after waste, fraud, and abuse. They expanded the enforcement folks. They didn't look so much as the patients. They looked at the providers. And that's where the, you know,
that's where
why
most
do you
of
bribe
the
a bank?
Is,
because that's where the money
most
is, right?
Most of the money is with the providers.
Most of the problem, and I saw that when I worked for the state controller, did audits, and that's where the big money is. And so what did the Clinton team do? They built up the team of people who were focused on waste, fraud, and abuse, and they found and they controlled some of the spending in that way. But these guys aren't doing that, just like with the IRS going after the those who are not paying their taxes at the upper end.
There's a provision in this bill, for instance, that says they should have a national accuracy clearinghouse for Medicaid and food stamps. And what that means is that if you're living in New York and you're on Medicaid and you move to New Jersey and you apply for Medicaid, New Jersey doesn't know whether the insurer is still getting a payment for you in New York.
Right.
The Wall Street Journal did a front page piece on this about a month ago. It's about if, and they put this provision in, and that's going to save about $30 billion over the next 10 years. You know, is that a cut to Medicaid? No. Even Bernie Sanders would agree that a state shouldn't be paying a capitated payment every month to a managed care organization for someone, the same person in two different states. We're doing the same thing now. They are doing the same thing now with SNAP. So there is a lot, and there's a lot of, you know, this business where we're going to pay a doctor who's affiliated with a hospital who does an outpatient treatment in their doctor's office or their outpatient clinic. We're going to pay them a hospital rate as opposed to an office physician rate. That's a big problem in Medicare, for instance, and that isn't even being touched in this bill. So, you know, there are so many ways in which, but all I'm saying, Teresa, you have very valid points, and I sympathize with, you know, someone that's in a dire situation, but we're spending federal revenue right now, or federal spending is now 25% of GDP. Our revenues are 18% of GDP. And that imbalance is going to kill our kids and grandchildren.
But I think we have some agreement here. I think there are ways that you can address the Medicare system, address the Medicaid system that wrings out some of that true waste, fraud, and abuse without disrupting patient care. And because if you kick off 13 million or more, many millions of people off the system, they're still going to need health care. And so what are they going to do? They're going to go back through the emergency room. And that's the most expensive way to do it. Or they're not going to get care. They're going to delay it until they're much sicker. And that's the most expensive. And what's the impact on health centers, rural hospital, urban sure. health centers, right? Then you get this cascading effect. It's better to have people insured, but go after, you know, where... Right. Go after where the problems are, which is on the provider
side. Let me give you another problem. In during the pandemic, the Congress and the Biden administration suspended eligibility determinations for Medicaid. So for 3 years, no one was redetermined whether they were eligible. It's estimated that there were 15 to 18 million people still on the Medicaid rolls who are no longer eligible because they don't meet the income qualifications. This bill is going to not only restore an annual recertification, but say you have to recertify every 6 months. And if you have the right technology and you use AI properly, you can assist in making these determinations.
Except for what's the calculation of how many people that's going to drive off the rolls because it's complicated to do and because you have people who are living at the margins. And the numbers are very high in terms of that provision, how many that's going to drive off the rolls. Yeah, I can't remember it off the top of my head. But it's a high number, John. It's well-intended. Just like the work requirement, well-intended, but the how they execute it is going to drive people off the rolls. And that's expensive to the system.
And well-executing government systems is often a, you know, its own contradiction in terms.
It's an oxymoron.
Right. Yeah.
Before John goes, can I fascinating conversation, but can I throw a question to you? And
sure.
That is, I sort of call what we've seen lately, sort of Kevin McCarthy and all the way up through now, politics by the tail end of both parties, right? And so you have members of the Republican Party who are holding out. They're actually doing their job. Like Mike Lawler's doing his job. He's supposed to be representing the local district on questions of state and local tax benefits, but he's holding the Republicans hostage in some ways.
It's a negotiation.
It's a negotiation, sure. Do you see that as problematic if we continue down the path of the tails holding on to?
I really don't. And you know, look, everyone out there who's on the salt issue, remember when they capped salt at $10,000, they also in that bill eliminated the alternative minimum tax for most people. And the alternative minimum tax, what did that do? It put back in the calculation of your taxes you no longer had a deduction for your state and local taxes because of the alternative minimum tax. So just simply restoring an unlimited salt deduction without putting the alternative minimum tax back in is highly costly and would be very inefficient. So I think that, you know, the tax system is really complicated and there are many pieces that you know, work together. But there are other things that are contradictory. And I do think the salt piece, they're up to 30,000. I think there's room for a little more. And I think the New Yorkers will get a little more. But you can't get everything they want. And you certainly can't restore the alternative minimum tax, which was a terrible tax policy.
What about the process question, John, of having so much in one bill to tackle?
It's bad.
Bad. And I think we hopefully can all agree.
And it's a big bad bill.
It's too much.
But how are you going to? I mean,
it's so many pages.
You have the conservative Republicans on one end saying we absolutely are not going to vote for this because it's not enough cuts, and then the moderate saying we're absolutely not going to vote for this because some of the cuts go too deep and too much is sent back to the states without the ability to pay. I can't get over the deep cuts in NOAA with the Weather Service. Can't everybody agree we should not be decimating them? But as a process question, John, I mean, where is this going? Is it the Titanic that Senator Johnson said, you know, the House bill's a Titanic, it's sinking and we have to start again?
Or what are your parting words for today, John?
Where do you think this is all headed?
I think they're ultimately going to compromise and resolve their differences and pass something. They've got to pass this by the August recess, frankly, because if they don't, politically for them, it's a disaster because there won't be certainty that businesses and taxpayers have out there as to making investments in the economy, and that will be a negative for them in the midterms. So they've got to have certainty in taxation, particularly business depreciation and things like that. They've got to have certainty in order to create more assurance where the economy is going. And
but do they bifurcate it like the Senate wants,
I don't
or do
think
they
so.
Do one bill? I think they do one bill?
I think they're going to do one bill, and when the president comes back from his trip, hopefully he and others will focus on getting the compromises that will be necessary, making this sausage in this process. It's not pretty. That's what Bismarck supposedly said one time, that the two things that people should never see being made are their laws and something else. I can't
laws
remember
and
what.
Sausage.
Sausage?
And sausage.
Laws
right.
and sausage.
He was German, so that's a good guess.
John Faso is on the panel this morning with Aaron Pasitti, Beau Breslin, and Teresa Bourgeois. John shall depart now, but the rest of us will remain in studio.
Great
thank
insights,
you, John.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Panel at WAM. Panel at WAMC.
Great donuts, great insights.
Guys, I'm trying to throw to a break. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We'll return right after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in studio this morning at this point with Teresa Bourgeois, Beau Breslin, and Aaron Pasitti. Remember, you can help ensure that WAMC remains on the air uninterrupted by supporting us anytime at WAMC.org. You can also email us, panel at WAMC.org, to join the conversation. We are talking about the budget bill, tax breaks, etc., going through committees this week in Congress. And we want to continue to discuss, as was just indicated, Aaron Pasitti is salivating to discuss it. It hasn't even had a chance. And so we give you that chance now.
I was being respectful because I knew John needed to leave. And I was curious
that.
To hear what
yes,
he had to say, because he's coming from probably a different side than I am on this. But and now that he's gone, I'm not going to just start digging into him so he can't respond. But a couple things to point out. When economists look at data, they usually don't look at dollar amounts, which might sound weird. But when you're talking about federal spending being $7 trillion, ooh, that's a big scary number. What economists do is they look at federal spending as a share of the size of the economy. So it's federal spending as a share of GDP. So the 50-year average, so John was making the case that, oh, you know, the federal spending doubled between, you know, over the last decade. Yes. But as a share of the economy, it's pretty much stayed constant. The 50-year average of federal spending or government spending as a share of GDP is 2.1%. In 2024, it was 23%. Government spending as a share of GDP has historically ranged between 20 and 25%. So you can throw out these big numbers like, oh, it's gone up by $1 trillion. Well, so is the size of the economy, so it washes out. The other thing that he said that was not correct was that the deficit as a share of GDP did go way up under Trump's term. Because there was a $1.5 trillion tax cut and the massive increase in spending. So in 2017, when Trump took office, the deficit, which is the difference between federal spending and tax revenue, was 2.5% of GDP. When Trump pre-COVID, it went up to 5%. So that's a double in the share of the deficit as the size of GDP. And then by the end of Biden's term in 2024, the deficit was 6%, meaning it was more or less where it was when Trump started. So you can throw out these numbers like trillions of dollars, but, you know, using that approach is a great way to lie and scare people with numbers and statistics. And what economists try to do, what good economists try to do, is to put that into a context. So always measure it as a share of GDP. So just some clarifications on that. The second issue that I want to talk about is that, you know, you have John was saying that, oh, you know, federal spending's out of control, the deficit's out of control. You've got all of these Republican deficit hawks talking about deficits being out of control. Deficits really don't matter. The only time deficits matter is if they explode and create high inflation and higher interest that bondholders demand to lend the government money. And there's no evidence in either of those areas that that's been the case. There was the late 60s, which was the one example of that. The issue, the deficit's the boogeyman. It's politicians explain it in a way that, like, well, households have to tighten their belt when times get tough, so should the government. And that's the exact opposite advice that Econ 101 professors give, is that government deficits are a private sector surplus, meaning when the government spends money or cuts taxes, that increases the government's deficit, but it makes the private sector richer. So deficits can be good for the economy in that they make the private sector richer. So the question isn't whether deficits are bad. The question that nobody wants to address is who benefits from the deficit. So with the Trump tax cuts and with this big disastrous bill, it's going to be millionaires and billionaires that benefit from the extension of the tax cuts. And
he minimized that dramatically.
Yeah. And so, yeah. Okay. So, yes. Listen, I would love to be in the category of people that pay 40% of all federal taxes. I would love to be a multimillionaire, and the biggest concern in my life is paying high taxes. Right? Like, would that it were so, but it's not. Anyway, Democrats like to increase the deficit to benefit middle and upper middle class households, and Republicans like to increase the deficit to benefit millionaires and billionaires. It's as simple as that. It's not, oh, the deficit's too high, the government needs to rein in its spending, it's out of control, we don't know what we're doing. That's just not true. There's no economic justification for reducing a deficit unless you start to see some negative macroeconomic effects. But getting back to the substance of the bill, I have a tough time seeing these savage cuts to Medicaid going through. Mm. If you look at the share of the population that receives Medicaid benefits, the top 7 states are all red.
Right. Mm-hmm.
New Mexico, Louisiana, Kentucky, West Virginia, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Alabama. A third of the population of those states receive some type of Medicare benefit. I'm sorry, Medicaid benefit. I have a
birthing
tough time.
Mothers primarily and seniors.
Yeah, right. Sure. So I have a tough time seeing politicians from those states being like, yes, I'm going to kick these people off the rolls and experience the political backlash. What is not often talked about is that there's these multiplier effects, is that, well, when you kick people off of Medicaid rolls, then all of a sudden you're going to see these hospitals and healthcare workers in these rural areas collapse.
This is a spiraling down that I'm worried about.
I know. And so if you look at healthcare employment as a share of all employment in those states, it's between 10 and 15%. So one out of every, call it 8 workers in those hardcore red states that are very, very poor, one out of every 8 jobs is in the healthcare sector. So if you make these savage cuts to Medicaid, you are going to destroy the economies, and not to mention the quality of life for, you know, the poorest 10, 15 states, which are predominantly red states. So I have a tough time seeing, I mean, this would be barbaric and cruel and savage if it went through. And if it did go through, I think people would finally realize that, Republicans are not, this populist Republican message is about or as Orwellian a term as you can devise. It's not populism. It's class warfare against middle class and poor people.
I know we need to get to Bo. Can I ask? They voted in lockstep, though, in committee. This is where Karen Tumulty, Washington Post, about this masterclass that the Democrats did. And they made this exact point. They put up person after person, and the Democrats gave examples not only of people, real-life examples of people on Medicaid in their own states, but then in districts where members of Congress were sitting right there, a Michigan member of Congress, I can't remember all the other places, but who's running for governor, but where saying, you know, these are people in your district who are going to be hurt by this. This is how many people in your district are you really going to vote for this? And at the end of 25 hours, sure enough, they did. I mean, that was stunning to me, but it'll be...
But that's different than a vote on the final bill when it really matters. Right. This is showmanship. Right.
But I do think it's the economic spiraling. And you think about that happening at the same time you have all this economic uncertainty because of the tariffs, right? And there's a lot of economic churning that I think is pretty precarious for the economy.
Not to mention all of the Doge layoffs that make everything run less smoothly because nobody knows how to run anything right now. Bo.
No worries, Teresa. I'm happy to. I'm actually just going to ask the three of you a question, and that is, Aaron, where do we go from here? Meaning, so for a lot of this feels like lather, rinse, repeat, right? So there's a lot of this negotiation that John talked about that's happening in various stages. This one feels a little bit different based on what you were saying because of the fact, and Teresa was saying, because of the fact that it's red states that are staring at the abyss of in a way that I haven't seen in a congressional bill in a long time. That said, I was interested in you calling deficits the boogeyman, right? There are lots of boogeymen out there. What is the long-term, how does Democrats and Republicans get together over the long term to figure out whether or not, how to talk even about deficits?
Very good questions. A key difference between the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was that there weren't these savage cuts to social programs. Right. What's being discussed now, that just blew up the deficit. Fine. Now they're trying to find cost offsets to help mitigate the deficit effects. And what is effectively happening is a transfer of wealth from lower income and middle income individuals to millionaires and billionaires. That's the easiest way to describe what's happening. You can call it class warfare. You can call it an upward redistribution of wealth. You can call it reverse Robin Hood. It's all the same thing. How do Democrats and Republicans come together to hash out some type of sensible policy going forward? You can have a high spending, high tax economy with a low deficit that grows rapidly. That's what happened from the end of World War II up until really Reagan was elected, right? You had massive amounts of government investment in infrastructure, jobs, education, research and development, funding for colleges and so on. And that was financed by extremely high taxes on the wealthy. So you had high spending, high outlays from the government, and high tax revenue. So the deficit was itself very small. Meaning the way we paid for those social programs that benefited middle-income families was through higher taxes on the wealthy. It was Robin Hood, effectively. Reagan reversed all of that. So you have politicians don't like to cut spending because it benefits people and constituents in their district.
They're doing their job.
And it's always popular to say, well, we're going to cut your taxes. Well, the effect of that is a higher deficit. So in this world of polarized politics, I don't see any way that once you account for the money in politics and the role of millionaires and billionaires, not just in campaign contributions, but also in getting appointed to unelected positions in the government, I don't see that there's any near-term fix to it. I mean, I know that isn't an answer that anybody wants to hear.
It's probably an honest one.
Yeah, no, it is. It's there's just going to be these fights about who benefits from deficit spending. There's a lot of policy alternatives, guaranteed employment, what was Biden's Build Back Better that got scaled down to the Inflation Reduction Act and the Infrastructure and Jobs Act and so on. I don't see that happening going forward.
But did you?
It's going to be me. Sherry writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, the media seems to be ignoring the fact that the major reforms, i.e. cuts in the current budget bill, don't kick in until 2029. How convenient to delay the pain until Trump leaves office, in parentheses, if he leaves on time. It's the height of political cowardice and hypocrisy to jump up and down about the waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicaid and the urgent need for reform and cost reductions, but to delay implementation for 4 years. We are up against a break and will return for our final portion of the roundtable panel after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke here in studio this morning with Teresa Bourgeois, Bo Breslin, and Aaron Pasitti. John Faso joined us earlier but was scheduled to depart at 10:30. Let us draw more on Aaron's expertise and discuss the current standing of the United States economy. Just that little old thing. This from the New York Times. The U.S. inflation cooled slightly in April in what economists warn could be a final lull before a likely surge in consumer prices stemming from President Trump's trade war. The better-than-expected report is welcome news for the Trump administration and the Federal Reserve, which has been trying to wrestle inflation down to its 2% target since the COVID-19 pandemic. But policymakers and economists do not expect the reprieve to last, forecasting prices to begin accelerating in coming months as important taxes start to bite. That from the New York Times, Aaron, educate us.
Celebrating this inflation report as good news is like celebrating a sunny day before you could go on vacation and it rains the whole week. This is the most meaningless inflation report probably in the 21st century. Yes, inflation showed
Should we make t-shirts commemorating it?
Yeah, uh-huh. Let's be very clear. Despite all of the Trump's backing down from these massive tariffs on China and the reciprocal tariffs on other countries, the trade war is alive and well and still poses an enormous and extremely dangerous threat to the economy. So yes, inflation cooled slightly on an annual basis, but on a month-to-month basis, from March to April, it actually increased by 0.2%. So that's kind of a leading indicator that we're just starting to see the tip of the iceberg. Here's why. Liberation Day, the liberation from economic security and predictability, was April 2nd. For goods that come from our main Asian trading partners, it takes about 2 weeks for those goods to leave a port in Asia and arrive at the port of LA. Once it arrives at the port of LA, it takes approximately, depending on where it's going, another week before it hits store shelves. So 3 weeks from April 2nd is April 23rd. Mm-hmm. So even if retailers pass those tariffs on immediately, you're only going to pick up 7 days of those. So there's really no news in this report. What economists have been saying, they've been saying exactly what I've been saying, but you're going to start to see the slow boil of inflation where it's 2.3%, meaning the cost of living for, you know, goods that consumers buy increased 2.3% from April of last year to April of this year. From here on out, you're going to see not the spike we saw in COVID, but we're going to see that kind of a slow boil where businesses are trying to figure out how much of that cost increase they can pass on. They don't want to pass on all of it because then they can erode their profit margins. They might lose some consumers. But you see Amazon already toying with showing what the effects of the tariffs were, and that got shot down fast because Jeff Bezos is a wimp. And Walmart's been talking about publicly how they're planning on starting to raise prices. So here's the bottom line. Most economists and financial firm forecasts are expecting inflation to go up from 2.3% now to about 3.5% to 4% by the end of the year. And that means consumers are going to be paying more. It reduces their purchasing power. But that also understates the true effect of the tariffs and inflation, because what's not going to be measured is the decrease in the standard of living from people who just don't buy those goods anymore because they're more expensive. So not only are you going to be paying more for the stuff you really need, you're going to be forgoing purchases of stuff that you just might want. So it's really a double whammy in the decrease of the standard of living. That's just the inflation and tariff side of it. Then there's, and I think Teresa alluded to this earlier, the uncertainty part. Oh, now we're striking a deal with the United Kingdom. Oh, now we're talking to China, right? This uncertainty about, well, are they going to go up? Are they going to go down? It's a 90-day pause. What happens after the end of 90 days? All that's going to do is really slam the brakes on business investment. And then when then you'll start to see a rise in layoffs. Then you start to see the decline in consumer spending. And this is essentially a perfect recipe for stagflation, which is slower growth, possibly a recession, and higher inflation.
What I worry about is a confluence of a range of factors, certainly the tariffs and the uncertainty around tariffs. And you'll see now that Trump caved on a number of things, but not completely. So that's why Walmart's announcing they're raising their prices. But it's only for 90 days. And so you'll get a big influx of goods in the next few weeks, right? So you'll have an over resupply because they're anticipating they don't know what's going to happen after 90 days. But in the meantime, as Canada and others say, they are going to continue trading now, but they are looking for other trading partners, right? Because they need to move to certainty, right? So you're going to have bump in purchases, right, coming in. But you're going to be the American, they're going to lose customers, right? They're going to lose customers from all over the world because of they can't handle the uncertainty. So there's a trade issue. But there's also the enormous number of federal workers. Now, that's going to hit some places harder than others, Virginia, Maryland, for instance. But all around the country, you have these loss of federal workers. But you also have the loss of the work that they were doing. And so there's going to be an economic cost to that. NOAA, for instance, and the Weather Service and such. And you compound that with all of the money that has been pulled back for grants to build solar, install solar panels and to, you know, do this, that, and the other thing. There's $890 million in law enforcement grants have been pulled back since April and so on and so forth. So you have all of that happening at the same time you have this budget bill going through with these anticipated cuts. And so what I worry about is the confluence of each one of these individually is destabilizing to the economy. And when people were, or, you know, still climbing out of COVID, still living at the margins, when people, you know, they don't have enough money to get through an emergency, then this, again, I am very worried about this spiraling down, this compounding itself, people losing their jobs for a whole host of different reasons. And you don't have the investments. Look at what they're doing to universities. Universities are laying off people because they're not investing in universities, which is, you know, in Foreign Affairs, the former president of MIT has a very fascinating piece, Raphael Reif, on the impact of failure to invest in universities and what does that do to our economy. But so what do you...
Yeah.
Bo, questions, comments? We have about 3 minutes left, guys.
I'm totally on Team Aaron and Team Teresa, right?
That's good to know.
I want that on a shirt.
Absolutely. I'm always on Team Sarah.
Oh, thank you.
But it makes perfect sense to me what the two of you are saying. What I'm focused on is the messaging that's going to come out, because it strikes me that inflation is going to go up, and the Trump administration has the biggest bullhorn. The beauty of the WAMCs of the world is that you have the Aarons and Teresas on to explain it in detail. But we live in a political world in which it's all about Twitter level messaging, and the Trump administration is phenomenal about that. Will they be able to blame this on Biden? That's always the first instinct. What's going to happen over the next several months? I'm sure they're going to try, but the messaging about why we're in a higher inflationary period, as you both have been talking about, is what I'm going to be focused on, and I think it's going to be fascinating.
So the fire breaks to this are 5 Republicans in the Senate and 5 Republicans in the House, right? And you need a John McCain moment, thumbs down, you know, where you're not going to kill the Affordable Care Act because you know the long-term benefits of it, which, I mean, so that to me is the fundamental question. Will the Republicans in the House and the Senate, who know that these numbers don't add up, who know the math is not mathing, will they be the firebreak to say, no, we are not going to create this downward spiral?
I'm super skeptical about that.
Yeah.
Want to take the final word, Aaron?
Sure. Consumers are already expecting higher inflation. So even if... I mean, and the Trump administration's admitted this is going to happen. That we're just going to have to get used to it. Kids are just going to have to, you know, get fewer dolls at Christmas time.
Only girls.
Only girls, right. he's admitting this. But once we start to see the real impact of these price increases, you know, there will be blame. He's remarkably savvy at figuring out how to do that in ways that other politicians can't. But I have a tough time seeing, given all of the hoopla about these tariffs and these negotiations, how he can blame that on Biden.
And of course, WAMC will continue to be here for as long as we are supported by the community to explore these issues on the roundtable panel and throughout our other programming. You can donate anytime at WAMC.org. Our panel this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Bo Breslin, John Faso, who left at 10:30, and Aaron Pasitti. Thank you all for being here as ever. Hope you have a lovely weekend. Again, you can support WAMC anytime at WAMC.org. In our next hour, we will hear a special entitled The Aging Mind. You're listening to The Roundtable.